You are listening to History Man, a project of ekbarnes.com, where we walk in the footsteps of heroes and proclaim freedom reigns. On today's podcast, we are featuring Dr. Eric Nason, a resident of Sumter, South Carolina, and the author of In the Presence of Wolves, The Adventures of Ranger Jacob Clark. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for having me.
Eric, well, we were talking before we started the podcast about how you got into the Revolutionary War. You were telling me where you grew up at. Tell our listeners kind of the genesis of what makes Dr. Eric Nason.
Well, I'm originally from upstate New York, about an hour north of Albany, a place called Glens Falls, which is literally in the middle of French and Indian War, the American Revolution. It was called the Great War Trail. Anything that would happen in the colonies, whether it's even way back to the Queen Anne's War, King George's War, everyone came through the Champlain Valley, coming from up where the Canada region through New York in the colonies. And I basically grew up in the middle of it. Fort Edward, Rogers Rangers, Fort William Henry's, last of the Mohicans. That's where I grew up. So as a young child, I'm immersed in living in the forest, living in the woods. So as I got older, my passion for history, and it's military history. As much as I like everything about history, it was always been military history. Drove my parents nuts. They wanted me to go do something else, but I always got into military history, which led me to joining the service. So from there, I became a ranger, a true ranger. I went into the Army, joined the 2nd Ranger Battalion. I was out there for about 3 years, and I decided to volunteer to the next step and go to Special Forces training. So my good friend, ranger buddy, also a passion for history, goes, hey, here's a hobby you should try. And he gave me his contact information to his parents who lived here. And at the time, it was in Lexington, South Carolina, and that's how I got into the American Revolution reenacting. Of course, that was it. The hook was sunk, and I wanted to learn more. So I dove into it. Even during my military career, I stayed with reenacting, and then I continued to work on my studies. So I tried to do college classes just to improve myself, but then I got into more history, into more history, into more history, and eventually took it all the way up to get a bachelor's, a master's, and eventually a doctorate in history.
That is fascinating. I know that if our listeners are looking for someone from a Revolutionary War standpoint to doing a reenacting, to do a personality from the Revolutionary War, I can't think of a better person to do that than you, Dr. Nason. You did a great job. I was actually able to go to the Francis Marion Symposium down here in Manning a couple weeks ago, and you were one of the headline speakers there, and you did a fantastic job. And I came away not only with knowledge, but I came away with an enthusiasm and a passion that it exudes off of you when you give your speeches and you give your reenactment, and I appreciate that.
Oh, I appreciate it.
So tell us a little bit about the genesis of your book. Tell us about your book and tell us how that came to be.
Actually, I used to do it as a project to relax. I've done scholarly papers on different aspects of the American Revolution. I like to focus on the guerrilla warfare aspect, being a former guerrilla warfare fighter. Being on the road at the time, I decided, I've done the scholarly papers. Let me do this to relax. And after a while, the story grew. So the main character is based on a conglomeration of ancestors. So I had 6 members serving the American Revolution. So his name base, Jacob Clark, is the name of my ancestor. So I decided then, okay, I'll just take the history and passion, start with the French and Indian War, because we haven't had a good book, not since Fenimore Cooper's book on Last of the Mohicans. Howard Coyle did one, but it's in Ohio Valley. Let's start back there. And from that, the book started to write itself. Most of it is considered historical fiction, but it is more fact than fiction. The places are real. I did a lot of research to find the original names that don't exist anymore. Rogers is Rogers, Stark is Stark. Only the few of the characters are made up.
So tell us just a little bit of maybe a story or two out of the book to get people excited about.
Well, Jacob Clark, he's based on my family. He's originally from York, Maine, but didn't exist back then. It was Massachusetts. So he was growing up on the frontier. It was an Indian raid that came to his house, which really did happen in my ancestors' history. The Indians walked up, knocked on the front door. His father answered the door. The Indian shot him, reached across the door, grabbed his younger brother, and took him to Canada. So the character, he's reliving that. He had been growing up with Stockbridge Indians, Mohawks. He's been a trader, long hunter, so he kind of knew. And unfortunately, his mother would die of a broken heart and disease. So he's left alone at about 12 years old. So he joins the Stockbridge Indians, which were Mohicans, and he also learned to live with the Mohawks. And by the time he was about 15, 16, he heard the call for, we need young, able-bodied scouts to join this thing called Rangers. So he would sign up at then what's called Fort Lyman under Robert Rogers and be one of the first company of Rangers to start fighting during the French and Indian War. So he'd be involved with the famous Battle of Lake George, Bloody Pond, the Bloody Morning Scout. And eventually, in the first book, he'll go all the way up to observing the massacre at Fort William Henry. And that's where this first book ends. The second book picks up just afterwards, and it continues on the great fight. I mean, how do you deal in this winter's terrain? So as part of the writing, I use my personal experience of being a reenactor, my personal experience of being, you know, on active duty, to describe what it's like to sit on an ambush line and get bored, to watch a little ant crawl, and you realize I should be watching the ground, and what's it like to see the silhouettes of people coming through. So the second book takes them all the way through that to this famous battle on snowshoes where Rogers almost gets captured by the French. And then eventually he will go up to Quebec, Canada. Those two books are complete. The third one right now, which is called Company of Wolves, is the later part of the French and Indian War where Quebec has fallen, Montreal has fallen. But now he's tasked to go to South Carolina because the governor has asked for help in fighting the Anglo-Cherokee War. So he's sent down here as an advance for Rogerson's company now, and he links up with Middleton's regiment and now working with men like Lawrence, Moultrie, and Marion during their portion of the French Indian War.
I was surprised to see, and I know this is a little rabbit hole. I have a tendency to go down rabbit holes. If you go out to historic Camden, they have several cannons out there that have been around for years and years and years. They weren't quite sure where they came from, but one of those cannons actually came from Fort Louisbourg.
Yes.
From the French and Indian War.
Right.
Up at the Canadian border, correct?
That was the capture, yeah. When the British, in order for them to take Quebec, they had to take Louisbourg. And it's fair game. During the American Revolution, we would take the cannons from Fort Ticonderoga to go to Boston. They took the guns from Fort Louisbourg to use down here in South Carolina.
So the makeup of the backcountry of South Carolina outside of Charleston, a lot of those were Scotch-Irish descent.
Yes.
Tell me the makeup of the people from a religious standpoint of upstate New York.
Very similar. For the most part, they're Puritans and Quakers. It's religious freedom. They all would come over to the colonies. They'd come into Plymouth, and from Plymouth, they went up into Massachusetts and Maine. Once the Dutch gave up New York, then same people would come up through New York to Albany, and they're just looking for their own freedoms.
I see.
So you have the cross-smattering of Quakers and Presbyterians and Catholics. But the Catholics, for the most part, stayed in the southern area where the Puritans and Quakers moved more upstate.
I see. What do you think all of this was fought over? I mean, you have the French and the Spanish fighting with the British over all of this. You have the British coming in and throwing the Dutch out. At what point, or what was the real catalyst for the revolution in your mind?
This point, it was kind of hard to say. We was always on a trail. It was going to happen.
Okay.
Anytime there was a major war in Europe, you're going to fight it here. So I talked about earlier, King George's War was actually the War of Spanish Succession. Queen Anne's War is the War of Austrian Succession. So even leaders such as Baron de Kalb, very famous at the Battle of Camden, Cornwallis, were all fighting these earlier wars or just up to the French and Indian War on each side, and they fought against each other. The catalyst, I think, in a lot of cases is it's kind of like today, you have a friction with your government that you're not happy. And it came down to literally the rule of three. You had those who were very strong supporters of the government. Whatever they wanted, we're going to support. Then you had the people who had the taste of freedom, that they've worked hard on their own lands, and they're committing. It's their blood. It's their sweat out there. Why can't they have a say? And then you have the neutrals who just, let me live, let me love my family, leave me alone, keep me out of this. Unfortunately, more of the friction came between those who wanted the government and those who do not. If you have this growing friction, you're going to have this fight.
Earlier today, I was thinking about other world events that are going on right now. We have China, mm-hmm. for instance, going on. And historically, China has always almost, for lack of a better term, kind of imploded, mm-hmm. Where the coastal regions, which are the more affluent regions, which have the trade and stuff, kind of, they gain all this wealth and they gain all this influence at the expense of the people on the interior of China, and the people in the interior of China mm-hmm. rise up against the coastal regions and stuff. I wonder if there's a parallel there between the colonies.
It did happen here in South Carolina. Okay. If you look, especially at the end of the French and Indian War, coming with the American Revolution, we have this thing called the Regulator War.
Okay.
It wasn't us and them. All the rich people, for the most part, with a lot of influence, lived in the coastal region of Charleston. That's where everyone first came in. From there, they start pushing up. So when the French Huguenots came in, the Germans, the Scots were moving to Orangeburg, Dorchester, moving up country. They didn't feel like the government was taking care of them. There was a lot of lawlessness following the French and Indian War, kind of lead towards the same loyalist pattern we see later on. Brigands, robberies were going on. They kept asking for help from the government, but it seemed like no one from the coast would come up. So they took matters into their own hands. And that led to what was called the Regulator War, which was about a 10-year period between the French and Indian War and the American Revolution that they fought for their own. It was a mini civil war because those who had the coastal regions and all the plantations didn't seem to mind that these little dirt farmers were trying to eke it out up here on the frontier with the Cherokee raiding and everything else. They took care of themselves. So very similar, very same parallels between what we see China today and what happened back then.
Tell me, what's a fascinating story that you've run across in your studies here in the backcountry of this, South Carolina, or in the South Carolina?
It's always
campaign.
Hard. Yeah, it's here. The Southern Campaign is so interesting and it's so overlooked. And there's so many individual, unique stories on what it took to be a partisan, especially being somebody who served with guerrillas overseas and everything else. The fact that you're willing to, you're risking not only your own life, but your family lives. All these, the different lives of these men. Peter Ory, I love following Peter Ory, was the fact that he was Marion's cavalry officer, but yet he's not very good at riding a horse. And in the heat of the moment, he had a very bad stuttering effect. It got to the point that even his men forgot what he had said. But it was enough that for a leader, he had come up through the ranks, he had served in the Continentals, and then when Marion selected him as part of his partisan leader, that he was Marion's strongest supporter. And he wrote such well. He's what we refer to, if we want to know what Marion did, look what Peter Ory wrote about. Not Weems or anything like this, because he was so devoted. And he knew he had these drawbacks. He knew that he fell off his horse all the time. And then his men just rolled their eyes and they rolled with it. But the fact that the men could trust him enough to, no, I'm not going to follow you. You can't ride a horse. Or I can't understand you. You stutter. And his men would still follow him in action.
Must have had some charisma.
He had charisma as a leader.
He had charisma that overcame all of his faults.
So, I mean, there's so many different stories, but I always like the story of Peter Ory.
Let me ask you this. Why did Peter Ory fight? He's at the coast, right?
Yes.
He's at the coast. He and Marion are both for the most part at the coast. Why are they fighting for liberty, or why are they fighting against the British?
For the most part, I think in a lot of cases, they weren't very much as the British as they're securing their freedom in South Carolina. This was a civil war. There were very few true British troops here in South Carolina. What you're dealing with are the American loyalists here. And he wanted to stop them. He wanted to stop, like, Thomas Fanning. And he wanted to stop Bloody Bill Cunningham.
So is this an offshoot of the Regulator movement, then?
It truly is.
Is it nothing more than a continuation of the Regulator movement?
Yes.
Blood against blood type of thing?
Blood against blood. It was. And what I found is a lot of the people who were involved earlier in the Regulator War as brigands did join the British side because they saw that this is a lawful means for me to go out there and loot and pillage and burn, but I'm doing it on behalf of the crown. So a lot of our patriots would join up to fight them. So if you imagine a Hatfield and McCoy type of feud, but across the entire South Carolina.
On steroids.
Yes, sir.
Good gracious.
Yes.
The Bill Cunningham story.
Yes.
I first ran into that in Jack Parker's book, and he kind of gave a list of all the dates and where he was at and who he killed and that sort of thing. Just fascinating. I never knew that until I read that book.
He was very brutal.
Tell me what you know about him.
Bloody Bill came out of the north. Just like, you know, we have our partisan leaders who kind of divide themselves amongst the state. Bloody Bill predominantly operated out of the upcountry. And same thing, he was
like from Lawrence, 96?
Yeah. That way up there. And so he operated, and he would personally go after, he'd know where the militia officers at or patriot officers at, and go raid their home. So when you look at like Walnut Grove, and where he shows up to pull the colonel out of his house to hang him and go after his family. They talk about the bloody deeds that Tarleton did sometimes pale to what Bloody Bill did. It's intimidation.
It really did. And he would take about 100 or so officers over with him. It wasn't like he just went out on his own and was just like this murderous guy. I mean, he was a murderous guy who had 100 other people.
He had
people.
A band. So if you imagine from his, how do you keep people supporting the Patriot movement? You scare them to death.
Right.
And that's what he did. if you continue to fight for the Patriots, I'm going to come find you. And you're going to be gone, but I'm going to find your family.
But it's interesting that he was actually a Patriot at the beginning of
yes,
the war.
Yes, he is.
And then he got into a little bit of trouble, got whipped.
Yes, got flogged.
Yes. And then he just said, enough of that, and then then joined over, went over to Georgia and joined up. Didn't
joined
he?
Over, yep.
So, and then he ended up at the end of the war. I think he ended up in Florida, and then Cuba, and then and died in the Bahamas somewhere. And very interesting story. He only lived to be about 31 years old. But
came back.
Man, he had a bloody
It was same with McKenzie. McKenzie was actually a member of the 2nd South Carolina. He was a Continental.
Okay.
He did something wrong, and Marion had him flogged. So when the city fell in 1780, and he asked, okay, who wants to switch sides? He threw his hand up and was like, I will lead your people. And his sole goal in life was to get Marion. So as Marion was operating with his partisans, McKenzie was leading his people. And eventually gets towards the end that he has no choice but to join Marion's side again. Because he realized, okay, the war is ending. I better make a choice. So here's another one of those interesting little forks in the road of history where one guy, again, same reason, he was flogged, changed sides, has to change sides again.
So I bet that was an awkward.
It was very awkward.
But didn't he and his group or his contingent of men, didn't they fight very well towards
they
the
still
end?
Fight well. Even Marion had to admit that they did a good job.
Yeah, but I
it's still, how do you trust somebody?
How do you trust them? I mean, they're in line with you with loaded weapons, right. And you're like, are they going to turn against
exactly.
us or what? You almost as a commander go, okay, I need about 20 guys over here on our flank to kind of keep an eye on
those five and when they're with you. Yes.
Yeah. So well, this is very interesting. Thank you so much. Let me ask you this, though. What does liberty mean to you?
There's so many different things. Coming from a veteran who has seen 20 years in special ops, I've actually been in a place. I've seen the liberation of Mosul. Okay. I've seen the true, when you see an oppressed people finally breathe fresh air that's legitimately called free. Makes it worthwhile. To me, that's liberty, whether it's on our side or another side. The fact that you can stand as a human being, whatever you want to be, and say, I am truly free to make my own choices, to make my own way, to support what I want to do, that's liberty. If you have to always answer to somebody, if you always got to ask permission, are you truly free? That's liberty. And I've seen it, and I've seen it unfold. And I believe is what my ancestors and those in the American Revolution seen when they heard that, especially down here on December 14th, when the British finally took that last step off the dock and got on their ships and sailed away, when they can truly say that South Carolina is free, they were truly free.
That's fantastic. Tell us how we can find your book.
A book, it can be found on Amazon, as well as Barnes & Noble's and Books A Million. But the first one is called In the Presence of Wolves. The second one's called In the Fury of Wolves. They're both out, so great for Christmas. And they're following the exploits. Jacob will move up through the ranks, and he will be a captain by the time he finishes book two and book three. I'm in editing now. Hopefully it should be out by next year. Will be when he will link up with a lot of the influencers for the American Revolution. And book four will be on the American Revolution as a Continental. And book five will be as a partisan leader. And by then, he's probably feeling his age. And then he's just going to finish out and try to enjoy
the
liberty.
So we're not just a one and done. This
no,
is a
sir,
series
this will
of
be a
books.
Series of books.
So who's your publisher?
Right now, Mascot Books does the first book. And Strategic Book Publishing does the second book.
Outstanding. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.